Hi, welcome to the Honeycomb Podcast, the podcast all about New Zealand food and drink and the people that make it happen. I'm Asher Boot, your host and owner of the ramen shop, Hillside Kitchen and Cellar, and Tinakori Bistro. Taking care of all the technical stuff is producer Steve Cochran of Rockpool Productions. On this episode, we speak to Tom Curtin of Tommy Millions and Lucky about making pizza, business, and owning multiple venues. All right, Tom, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Asher.
Hey, let's just go right back to your background. How did you get started in hospo?
Well, I guess relatively, I was a late bloomer to the industry. Grew up in rural Hawke's Bay on apple orchards. Spent a lot of time in farms, so that was sort of my work through high school was more agricultural than hospitality. I had one summer up in Auckland with my auntie when I was about, I must have been about 14 or 15. So she's a chef, classically trained, Savoy in London. Moved back to Auckland and set up a catering company, must have been about 25 years ago. And we, all my brothers and I, got shipped off to Auntie Sue for summers in the dish pit. Yep. And that was my first taste of the industry, a good 3 months washing dishes. And it really stuck with me. I was just enamored by the chefs and what they got up to, both on shift, but more relevant off shift, which was very exciting for me as a 15-year-old boy from the sticks in Hawke's Bay. So I sort of had a little flame kindled there and sat on that, became quite interested in food and sort of personal capacity, cooking dinner parties, cooking for friends, but nothing professional until after university, actually. And I shot off overseas, as many do, to Canada for a year and ended up in Montreal. And it's obviously a predominantly French-speaking country. The options for work for me were pretty limited to, as I found out, call centers or hospitality.
Yeah.
And I ended up applying for a job in a place on the English side of town, a little kind of bistro there, and got the job on the first day. They must have been very desperate, or I was quite proficient in padding my non-existent CV.
Yeah.
And so that was first a taste of blind cooking and working full-time in a restaurant. I had very few skills, but some great teachers there.
Yeah.
Learned some bits and pieces and ended up working for the best part of a year. During that time, I also met a couple of guys who worked in that kitchen who had worked at a pizzeria nearby, also in Montreal, and they lined up through some connections with a sort of little kind of stagey type situation where I went and worked a couple of shifts there because I was, for some reason, really interested in pizza dough. Montreal being very close to New York, we shot down a couple of times for little holidays and got exposed to New York-style pizza there.
Yep.
Never really realized the path I was on until I got back to New Zealand and started in an office job, which in the course that I studied law at university, so I ended up in a law job. And within, it was about 3 weeks, I realized that, the path I was on wasn't going to work out. All I could think about was pizza ovens, restaurants. I was spending, I'd set up my office so that no one could see my screen. I was just reading eater.com, pizzamaking.com, watching Bourdain clips and just absolutely obsessed with food.
Yeah.
And decided that I wanted to make a pretty drastic path change, leaving the law firm quite abruptly, still hold the record for the shortest career. There, 3 weeks, found a pizza oven on Trade Me, moved back to the Hawke's Bay for a short while and started learning how to use that pizza oven. It was a wood-fired trailer oven and then had the intention of coming back to Wellington to try to set up a catering company.
Yeah,
I remember there was one point where I spotted a newspaper article with someone tossing dough. It was in the Dawn Post. I think it was front page, and it was the guys from Scorpa, so it was Leonardo and one of his pizza makers. I think it was the Italian festival they were advertising. And I hadn't heard of the guys before, but saw these guys tossing dough, having a good time talking about their businesses, and decided that I wanted to try to work for them and learn more about pizza in a restaurant context.
When was that?
That would have been, I finished uni 2006, year in Canada 2007, so this was 2008.
Cool.
Yeah, so I ended up moving back down, convinced the guys at Scorpa to give me a job in exchange for the ability to use their prep kitchen in the weekends. The plan was to run mobile events with my pizza oven.
Yep.
We'd called the business NYPD at that time. It was my brother and I out there. So we lined up gigs we first got into the Sunday markets down at Harbourside, had a stall there, and then picked up whatever we could on Saturdays, various street fests. We ended up cracking into Weta as well, which was great. During the weeks, I'd work at Scorpa, and the weekends run gigs with my bro, and in any spare time, just absolutely nerd out about pizza and just really try to push my skills and knowledge forward.
Yeah.
And so that played out for, I must have been about 3 or 4 years, and it was all great. NYPD was what I thought was quite a successful business at the time before I knew too much about the IRD and various other things of that nature that are very important to the operating of business.
Yeah.
And we'd always sort of talked about, so between myself and Leonardo and Lorenzo, the brothers who run Scorpa and various other places, and now my business partner, Simon, we'd always talked about wanting to do New York style pizza, wanting to do it by the slice somewhere. And that was always on the cards. And it took a few years to find the right site. We were always just waiting for the right site to come along. We had a crack at a couple, but again, through the Don Post, I found out about the Courtney Place, what was the public toilets being up for. It was someone had a resource consent to run a bar in there, and that had lapsed. So the council was looking for a new operator to come in and breathe some life into it. They had a tender process, which we were a part of. There were a lot of people gunning for it. We were fortunate to win that process, and the ability to develop that site into what at that time was going to be a pizza by the slice and coffee roasting and espresso coffee joint, which came to be Tommy Millions 1.0 in 4th of July 2012.
Cool.
Was opening day. Yeah.
Great day for it.
We actually deferred a couple of weeks so we could hit 4th of July. Yeah, it just seemed right.
Hey, I just want to jump back a little bit.
Sure.
Growing up in the Hawke's Bay, whereabouts?
So most of the time in Jervois Town, so just outside of Taradale.
Yep.
So we had apple and pear orchards there. That was most of my teenage years.
Yeah.
So summers were spent picking, thinning, mowing.
I'm just always fascinated in the amount of people now, and it's a continuous thing, who have been exposed to raw food or primary produce at a young age, who come through in the hospital industry.
Yeah.
And how do you feel that affects you in terms of ingredients?
I feel such a massive connection to primary growers, to the a real understanding of the effort that goes in to get something from seed to supermarket or wholesaler.
Yeah.
And just having seen my father, he went in sort of blind into the apples and pears. Had a booming first year. I thought he was on to an absolute winner. And from then on, the bottom of the market fell out for various reasons, and it was always a real struggle. I mean, we did okay, but it was always a real struggle. And lots of hard workers are seeing the amount of effort he put in personally, 7 days a week, and also the squad of 4 boys that he had produced getting out there and spending so much time on the orchard. I think you really do achieve a connection with the primary product and the growers.
Yeah,
and I think you had a similar experience growing up in King Country, right?
That's right. Yeah. I grew up on a sheep and beef farm, King Country, but then also, the southern Hawke's Bay, Wairarapa sort of border.
Oh, right. Okay.
So knowing that area, it is a great food production area.
Yeah, sure.
And you do get exposed to some really high quality stuff early on, crayfish from the beach and,
absolutely.
And those sorts of things. So, I think it does genuinely get in your veins.
It really does. I can't look at an apple display in a supermarket without knowing what's going in there.
Yeah.
And wondering why there's royal galas there in the end of August.
Yes. Let's not talk about that list that they use of priority when they come to picking fruit that's going to go on supermarket shelves.
Yeah, sure.
That's horrible. That's cool. Okay, so Tommy Millions open 4th of July.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you started off using a trailer, then into Tommy Millions to now. How much has your base changed in that time?
The dough?
Yeah.
Well, so the biggest change was moving from wood-fired, which the NYPD was, to gas-fired, which Tommy Millions is. There were several reasons behind the change, mainly due to the Courtney Place store. We literally weren't allowed to use wood with the way the extraction would have worked in the neighboring building. So the choice was forced. But there were also some stylistic reasons behind the decision. And a New York style street pizza is traditionally made in gas ovens or electric. They moved away from coal a long time ago. And there's lots of reasons for that. They're easier to use, easier to train people on, cheaper to run. But also for me, there was an aesthetic advantage. With the Tommy's Courtney Place location, you're always eating on the run. There's nowhere to sit down. So slices need to be able to hold their own weight. And the cook in a wood-fired oven is a lot faster and produces the bubbly crust and the softer middles that people associate more with Neapolitan pizza. And it's not that much fun to try to eat that on the go.
No.
It's a style of pizza that has an awesome place in my heart, but that's sit-down pizza.
You also traditionally eat it with a knife and fork.
Yeah. So we the cooking method changed, and then dough needs to change with that. Wood fire dough that we used to make for NYPD was a lot wetter. So it was around are you familiar with hydration percentages? So we used to push it pretty hard, up to about 67, 70% some days. with lots of stretches and folds during the bulk ferment for the NYPD, because I knew that I would be making all of the pizzas by hand and was pretty well versed and pretty confident with using and stretching wet dough to 18 inches, which not because I'm special, I just had a lot of practice at it, and it's not something that is easy to teach new pizza makers. There's lots of mistakes, there's lots of rips and misshapen pizzas. So we dialed back the hydration with what we do now at Tommy's. It's around the 60 to 62.
Okay.
It varies a bit with time of year. And we originally used to have a little bit of sweetening. So we used to use sugar, and at times we'd use a little bit of honey in the dough and a little bit of olive oil. But now with Tommy's, it's just a straight dough. So just flour, water, salt, yeast.
Yeah,
and throughout old NYPD days, we did experiment a bit with natural fermentation, so wild yeast. But we're not able to confidently have a system where that could apply in Tommy's with the volume we were producing, the window of usability it needed with being open all day, all night, every day. It's very challenging, and I do take my hat off to anyone that I know uses uses wild yeast in a high volume commercial pizzeria.
It's different to loaves, isn't it? Because loaves, you can time your day out and be structured and all that sort of thing, whereas you don't know when someone's going to order a pizza.
We need to have a usability window of at least 24 hours in peak condition, and to achieve that without commercial yeast is something that's beyond my little brain.
What sort of yeast do you use?
We use instant dry. So it doesn't require proofing.
Straight into it.
There was no real reason behind that. It's more easily available than fresh yeast. But my understanding of yeast is, commercial yeast is that they essentially do the same thing, just have different strengths. And with active, you need to proof. And with fresh, you need to use a lot more.
Yeah, cool. And what about flour?
So, we have changed several flours over the years. The style of pizza we were shooting for is generally made with what they would call in the States high gluten flour, so strong baker's flour. We tried all of the different brands available in New Zealand, tried blends of them, and in the end we settled on what we still use today, which thankfully it was quite straightforward. It was the best we could find, the strongest we could find. It's a, I guess I can say the name, it's a Western Milling victory flour, so it's about 13% protein, so one of the stronger flours available on the market. And that does the trick for us.
Great.
Yeah.
Fascinating. How much dough would you make in a day at the moment?
So we make dough at least five times a week. Yep. We have an offsite prep kitchen, which is just dedicated to dough. And at the moment we go through, each week it's 1,000 kilos of flour. So 50 bags of flour.
Ton of flour.
Yeah. So dough at 60% hydration, that's about 1,600 kilos of dough.
Yeah. Wow.
It's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And it's got to move out to the sites every day. Yeah. So there's a lot of logistics, moving parts and a lot of fridge space needed in tiny kitchens all around town.
So three sites?
Yeah. So first one, 2012, Courtney Place. Second one was Featherston Street in 2015. And then last year we opened in Willis Street Press Hall.
Yep.
So yeah, 1, 2, 3. They're all pretty much takeaway. Featherston Street has a bit of standing space, but the model, it really requires, we're not selling booze, we're just selling slices. We need to keep floor size as small as possible and
you've got to
turn and burn them.
Last year we opened a second ramen shop in the city, and the whole idea was coming to the city was going to be a godsend, it was going to be awesome, it was going to be amazing, and it wasn't. It was actually really hard to work out how this thing that we do really well and that we really care about didn't get the same reaction in the city. How was that for you going from new sites, and do you find the clientele or the reception different in each place?
Yeah, there was quite a noticeable. I mean, the different sites have different markets just by design, by where they are. I mean, obviously, Featherston Street is very much a corporate environment, and Courtney Place is more of the party town. I guess the reception, which might be something you experienced as well, changed the most, I think, due to a perception of the business changing, and that it went from this little dinky joint that I was in every day.
Yeah.
People, I think, associated that me with the place to what was perceived as an expanding chain, dare I say. I think there was a lot of people who thought and continue to think that it's an American chain that's been transplanted here, and the way that customers engage with a business that they don't think is a mom and pop joint is quite different.
It is.
You notice a tone in any type of, say, complaint that we might have shifted to, I guess you might call it nastier or less forgiving of what might, in the bigger scheme of things, have actually been quite a small mistake on our part, which that's fine. That's part of it, part of the game as well. But I did notice that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, we are connected to our prep kitchen here. Mm. We make our broths in a 170-litre pot, and that broth will be split between sites. I mean, we don't have CVD ramen or semi-permanent ramen anymore, so that doesn't happen. But we could literally take broth from one pot, serve it in two different sites, and get different feedback.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And people saying, this isn't anything like the other one.
Absolutely. Know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so much of that.
And that's really hard to deal with. Like, we're going to jump forward here because I want to talk about this later. You on social media is fascinating.
Some fun.
But you're really honest, right? Mm-hmm. Like you actually let people see what it's like being a restaurant owner and the feedback you get from customers. How did you make that decision in terms of being quite open about putting out when someone says something negative and you're quite happy to cut them down? And I think that's cool. Is that your personality coming through, or is that part of a business plan?
Well, I try to avoid direct cutting down in favor of more just peeling back the curtain to show the type of things that we are sent on a frequent basis.
Yep.
Sometimes there is. Sometimes it verges into that territory. I never really understood social media or had any training in it. So it was very much an organic development of, a style and a voice mainly on Instagram.
Yep.
And a lot of the time it wasn't really conscious. It was just me literally writing posts in my pocket in response to something that might have just come through, probably with a bit of a hot head or just a bit being a bit sarcastic, and noticed that it got traction and people seem to appreciate and engage with it for the most part. Doesn't always go well, and that's fine. And sort of, I guess, stuck with that style. And I mean, it's not our entire social media presence, but forms probably the most engaging part because people seem to dig it and think it was illuminating.
I mean, this is a challenge that I've intentionally avoided, but like, you are Tommy Million.
Yeah. So that took a lot of persuading. That was, we went through, throughout the course that we were developing the site originally, so back in 2011, from day one, my partners wanted to call it Tommy Millions and I wanted to call it anything but Tommy Millions for this exact reason of not feeling confident. I'm not naturally an extroverted person or didn't consider myself someone with the confidence to put the face in the box kind of thing. And, over time, they wore me down a bit. the main argument was that food businesses, businesses, particularly food, that have a personal tone and have an association with humans and not with machines, I think are quite powerful. There's a long history in pizzerias of naming after the owner. It's almost every joint in New York will have a Sally, Pepe, John, Joe, Pat. So, it was sort of an intentional thing that I came around to, and I don't regret it at all. I think it was a wise move, but it's still weird to see. I mean, we're looking at a couple of boxes now to see an old face on a box. It's still weird, and T-shirts. It's super weird.
Yeah. I mean, I have always, and I haven't been successful at it a lot of the time, but I've always tried to not have me as the place.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Hillside's been the hardest for that.
Yeah. What's your thinking there?
Yeah, I don't know. And it is, I'm the same. I'm very much an introvert. I don't like, you know,
The spotlight
at all. That's, that's not my thing. And I'm very much, I like to see other people succeeding and helping them out and things like that. But also it was purely from, I think fear is the wrong word, but restaurants fail.
Sure.
Right? And I didn't want to be overly, I wanted to be able to make business decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping a level of not being too sentimental about anything. Was really important to me.
Yeah, I think that there's a strong argument that it's good thinking. I guess I've kind of gone in another direction in that having my name and identity so closely associated with it has been my motivation on at the hardest times to not let this screw up and not let this go down because for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And that has actually been useful motivation.
Nice.
Yep, absolutely.
That's great. Hard times.
But I understand where you're coming from too. And but for the pushing of Nadi and Enzo and Simon, that would have likely been the outcome, and it would have been called, I don't know, Fat Pizza or something. Yeah. I think that was being thrown around.
I think that's really interesting. And having that outside input has got to be really valuable. Mm. You know, it's something that, again, you know, I've struggled with at times because I make a decision, I make it in my head, and I've weighed it up to such a huge extent by the time I'll vocalize it to anyone. That I can be quite stubborn from then on.
Sure.
You know? And also I've got a team that is amazing, and they'll kind of let me do stuff, which isn't necessarily the best thing at times as well.
Yeah, I'm eternally grateful for the dynamic of our partnership, and it's I'm far happier having a smaller piece of the growing pie than all of it to myself, because they keep me in check, particularly Simon. We have a very, very close working relationship, and he has a very level, very customer-focused perspective, and that has been super useful in guiding some of our most important decision-making.
I mean, that's so important as a cook or a chef, being able to be convinced that empathy, I think, is one of the most important things, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And getting that customer-focused perspective is huge.
Sure.
Yeah. You mentioned hard times.
Mm-hmm.
What's it been like being a business owner? Because you also would have, I mean, you've been at Scopa through the, you know, global financial crisis, the boom of the World Cup, the boom of Weta, you know, the ups and downs. I think the last year, I mean, for us anyway, the last year has been one of the worst in terms of the economic climate, I guess. How's it been?
It's a constant challenge. I guess there might be a perception that the further you get into the game and the more established you are, that things can just coast on their own momentum. And that's just couldn't be further from the truth.
Yeah.
There's constant pressure, financial. We're blessed to have done reasonably well, that we're, you know, we're not in danger of the lights being turned off at any point soon, but there's still constant tweaking, constant training, and constant pressure around making sure that the formula fits, that your costs are in line, that your pricing's right, that your business is going to break even.
Yeah.
And it's, we've had tough times in the past, and at the moment we're going through a process of reviewing the menu, reviewing the prices. We've held off for 7 years on price increase, but that will need to change. I'm sorry, everyone out there. It has to change. And those are decisions that the pizza maker in me really, really doesn't want to make, and we want to be as generous as we can with our offering. But the businessman developing inside me, I'm not quite there, knows that it needs to happen. So there's constant fine-tuning of any business worth its salt.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's the only thing I can put to that. Looking at prices, I mean, that is really hard, because hospitality is about being hospitable, right? And so you don't want to have to challenge your customer from that point of view in terms of thinking about costs. You just want it to be good. The one that I try to work on is value.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always try to look at value.
Sure.
Not necessarily from even a dollar point of view, but, you know, always thinking about what's the value we're giving to people here. What's
of the experience as a whole.
Yeah, as a whole, and things like that. And when you start looking at everything that you do for customers, then it's a bit easier to go, actually, we need to charge this to be able to keep doing this.
Sure. Yeah, I've heard you speak on this before, and I've found it lines up with my thinking as well.
Yeah.
And really considering about the experience as a whole that you're offering, and being sure to place some value on that, and as most customers do too. They
absolutely,
the dining out, even if it's, I mean, it might be a full Dego at Hillside, or it might be a slice of pizza on the go, they're buying more than what's on the plate. I think a lot of the dining public realize that. There is still obviously the niggly, I could make that at home for X mentality, which is so common.
I had a fantastic conversation. There was a journalist over as Paula Wellington on Plate that writes for multiple publications internationally, based in Tokyo. She was great.
Right.
And we talked about, next time someone says that, sitting them down and going, are you okay? Because you value yourself really lowly. Mm-hmm. If you think you can produce what we do yourself for the same price.
Wow. Oh, that's a great take, sure.
You know, because the hours spent getting the ingredients, cooking the ingredients, cleaning up afterwards, all that sort of stuff, plus the cost of the ingredients, plus the cost of all the other options that you've got to make for your guests as well, same as what you can get in a restaurant, plus having the wine cellar, plus, you know, if you start adding all this sort of stuff up, someone that's saying that is valuing their time at, what, 50 cents an hour?
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. But that, I just don't think those, in the minds of people who haven't had any exposure to either business or the hospitality industry, those dots wouldn't join, but I think they can. And if you have those types of conversations and try to convey that we are all here, well, I can't speak for everyone, for the most part, here to provide the most generous and the most value-driven experience that we can.
Yeah.
But
that's hard to get across.
It really is, yeah.
Because also we're taught in hospo, you know, the customer's always right. Mm,
sure.
And so you can't come back. Yeah. You know, what do you say? And you don't have time to either, because you've got other people to look after.
We've dealt with that one a lot of times, especially with, in the pizza game, there's the direct reference point, which the majority of pizza consumed in New Zealand by necessity is the big chains, which are priced at massively distorted low pricing, and that has become the benchmark for what a pizza ought to cost, you know, $5 or $5.95. But I mean, the apples and oranges factor is pretty obvious there if you take a moment. But I do understand why the benchmark in people's minds is that low with pizza.
Yeah. I found it really interesting. I mean, you've brought it up a few times, and obviously with the branding and all that, but the New York style pizza, how tightly do you hold on to that identity of trying to be a New York pizza? Yeah.
Well, this is interesting. We actually don't anywhere in any type of, on the website or any type of branding or media use the words New York.
Okay.
And that's been quite intentional. I know I've said it several times here because that is where I've trained several times and gone for several stages, and it's the obvious reference point. It's where my heart in the pizza world lies. But the idea was, I think how I used to put it was, it's not New York style, it's New York inspired. So trying to take the spirit of what they do there and what I've eaten so much of and loved so dearly, and reinterpret that in a New Zealand context. So we don't have Wisconsin dried mozzarella readily available unless you bring it in on shipping containers frozen, which we use fresh mozzarella from Auckland, from Massimo's, and I mean there's flavor combinations that we do that you wouldn't find in New York, and the specials we do you might not find on the street there, but the reference point is always being New York.
Yep.
And I just didn't want to sort of ram that down people's throats. I find it strange to want to celebrate being from somewhere else, but from where you are, particularly if you're flying in ingredients and really trying to create this authentic experience, which is almost the opposite of if you're using what's not from where you are.
That's so true.
It can be said of many Italian restaurants worldwide.
Hugely. I mean, one of my most annoyed Tuscan food, right? And you know, someone will say, oh yeah, this cheese shipped over from Tuscany to make this authentic. That is the least authentic thing you can do to a regional cuisine, is to get something from the other side of the world,
particularly something so hyper-regional as Italy, and something so revered locally. I imagine
it's nuts. Do you ever encounter, I've been to New York and I've had pizza.
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. It almost daily basis. I'm from New York, I'm going to be judging this with a keener eye, and that's cool. I understand it. I'd probably, if someone was doing fish and chips in New York and I went over, I'd be like, like I said, we're quite overtly not saying that we are New York style pizza, and that's fine if that.
Yep.
Like if they have a long history of eating pizza, they probably will have a stronger opinion, and particularly if they're a New Yorker. They take it pretty serious over there.
Yep. No, people have been to Japan and have ramen.
Yep, sure.
Awesome like that.
And I think like that's, I understand the mentality, but I would, when I approach any type of eating personally, like I try to come in with an open mind with the objective of, I mean, is this delicious? That ought to be the question, not is this quote unquote authentic, or does this line up with what I experienced growing up in a particular place. It's just delicious, the delicious factor.
Yeah. You mentioned cheese from Auckland.
Mm-hmm.
Do you look for New Zealand ingredients first and foremost?
Some things are hard to find, particularly hard cheeses. Yep. Will tend to come from Italy, so some of the ones that we do. But Massimo in particular, so the fresh cheeses, mainly ricotta and mozzarella, we were quite fortunate to link up with Massimo. This is probably my most valued supplier relationship that I've ever had, and one that I've told every rep in town that will never ever
go away from
unless something happened to Massimo. So he had been on holiday in New Zealand from somewhere outside Naples. He's Italian, and was appalled by the quality of mozzarella in the supermarket, and decided he was going to move his family to Auckland and set up a mozzarella factory. And this was about the same time as Tommy's was first starting, so around 2011. And I just read about him in Cuisine somehow, and flew up to meet him because it just seemed, we corresponded a bit, then I wanted to go up and meet the guy and see what he was all about. And he was just the most sincere, passionate and dedicated producer that I've ever encountered. And we've sort of grown with him. So we signed supply agreements with him for a year at a time with certain quantities that allowed him to scale up and to guarantee some of the investment and plant that he needed.
Yeah.
And he's grown sort of at a similar rate to us, to the point now that he's one of the, he's just, I don't know the numbers, but he's banging out a ton of mozz, and it's in the supermarkets all around the country. Throughout that, he's still on the coalface every day.
Well, and it's good.
And it's good. And that's the beauty of it. It's good. And he reacts to the feedback we give him around moisture content, particularly, even color, things like that, and tries to really achieve the product that we wanted for our pizza. So that's one that I've have been quite proud to have developed. Cured meats can be a challenge in New Zealand on a large scale. There's some great boutique small goods producers, but we are currently trying to figure out a supply of a New Zealand free-range pepperoni, they're calling it, for the first time, first one that's been at market at scale. I'm sure you could Google those words and find out the name of the brand. I won't say anything because we haven't locked it down. But if we can find those relationships and nurture them, and that's mutually, it works out in terms of ability to supply and price point, then we would love to cherish, love to develop local relationships.
That's cool. Exciting. Hey, you mentioned before changing menu, looking at bits and pieces. What's happening? What's the deal? What's going on?
Well, the cat's still in the bag a little bit, so I've been not let it ride out, but we're making a couple of changes to the menu, which will include, unfortunately, the removal of some time-tested favourites. We only have, at the moment, 7 pizzas on the menu, and that will be pretty much the same. There might be an 8th, but we just wanted to switch it up. We've had the same menu for 7 years. There's a chance now with a couple of, like I mentioned, a couple of renovations we're doing to install new display cabinets that can hold the wider range, and we've just decided we want to switch a couple of things. So it'd be interesting to see how that goes. We know that people feel very strongly about particular flavors. There's loyal fans.
I mean, is that something though that you can bring back as a special every now and then?
That's the idea. So we've always got this, the special pizza which rotates, and we're going to introduce the pies that have come off will be seen again as specials. On a rotate, like a regular, predictable rotating basis. So they're not going to disappear. It's time for a change, man. And as I mentioned before, I sort of took a leaf out of your book and coming to terms with that decision, and was quite an admirer of what you did at Hillside in particular. And and in terms of like a overhaul of your offering and dealing with the feedback that generates, I was quite keen to hear your perspective on that and how that mental maths went for you.
Yeah. For me, it wasn't that big a decision for me. Once again, I process things a lot internally and kind of go through a lot of scenarios. I'm pretty hard on myself with that sort of thing.
Right.
And then I can work through things afterwards. But once I'd kind of made a bit of a decision, I went back through our sales at Hillside for 3 years and did a percentage calculation of how much vegetable-based dishes do we sell and how much meat-based. And honestly, we still sold a lot more vegetable-based dishes.
Wow.
Because of the style of food we were already doing, right? And even a dish that had meat on it.
It wasn't the star.
Half the time, it wasn't the star. And that was the style of food that we opened with. And Hillside probably opened a year, maybe 2 years too early in terms of where the market was at. But, you know, we came in doing set menus, foraging. You know, weird offering, bistronomy type stuff. And I looked at what was happening in Wellington, and I saw a lot of the market coming towards that more and more. And it was more and more that happening at other venues. And for me, Hillside is a flagship type restaurant. So it had to progress. And how do you progress that? And literally the first thing that came to me was, we'll stop serving meat.
Well, from where I stand, it's a brave decision that seemed ahead of its time at the time, but now seems quite in line with, I think, international thinking, and hopefully for you and for your team, local thinking as well.
Well, that's it. And that team, which is something I want to talk to you about, is the other thing that came into it. With tiny restaurant, you need to get a certain amount of turnover to pay for it and things like that, which means you can't carry too many staff. How do you make the menu more focused so it's more doable, streamlined, all that sort of stuff? And that made a lot more sense as well. And the relationship with suppliers, like everything just kept ticking boxes all the way through.
I bet your cooks love you for it.
Yeah. It's,
know exactly what they're selling, what needs to be in the fridge.
Well, we were able to do really cool stuff though. Like we took out a stainless steel bench because every kitchen has a stainless steel bench. We're not serving meat. So we got this big wooden bench as the main bench in a kitchen, and we could set it at a height that was more comfortable to work on and all sorts of things that are knock-on effects of this. And I firmly believe that Hillside is a better restaurant than it's ever been now.
Oh, great. That's a great place to be in.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, our next step is we've got a plot of land that we're going to start growing a lot more produce on. So that restaurant experience, that value product, you're going to be able to get things that we grew on your plate, you know, that we've tended from seed all the way through, and getting that connection back to that primary producer type of thing.
And will you have your chefs working, spending time in the garden?
Yeah. I mean, we already do out the back of the restaurant. We grow quite a lot, but this is going to be an extension of that. And we're going to be able to grow varieties that you can't buy in the supermarket.
Oh, great. You know, that's awesome to hear.
Some of that sort of stuff. So this little thing, and I really appreciate it when you talked about, you know, talking about having a cabinet change. So you get to change a whole lot of other stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, being able to change what we offered, it enabled us to look at so many other things that we could change at the same time and really refine.
Yeah, it is really easy to get caught in that blinkered view of things that this is how it works.
Yeah.
We fear change, that kind of thing.
Exactly.
But everything that we have done over the years in terms of change has generally landed well. I mean, Lucky was a good example of that, or something that was sort of an accident and has become a beast of its own.
Yeah, so what drove that?
So Lucky is a fried chicken offering out of the Courtney Place building. We originally had the coffee roaster in there, and we're producing our own coffee and wholesaling a little of it, but mainly within our own restaurants, Gentleman's Beans. It became impractical to have a roasting operation in such a high rent location. Yep. So you can do it effectively anywhere, and the thinking was, let's move it and turn the space into something that has a retail element. So we moved that off-site, and then the thinking was, what can we do in this tiny space? It's about 12 square meters. It had a weird shape. It's a historic building, and at that point, limited extraction. And we just knew that it had to be fast. By its nature, there's no seats. It's a pass-by location. Needed to have a small footprint and needed to be super delicious at any time of day or night.
Yep.
And fried chickens just was the logic. I mean, all signs pointed to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'd always had a soft spot for fried chicken and started developing recipes and launched Lucky, must have been about 2 years ago. And it has, just surprised all of us by the speed at which it's taken off and the place it now seems to hold in people's hearts.
Yeah, it's great.
So, it's great fun.
Did you ever worry about, because they're similar offerings.
Mm.
So do they feed each other or do they draw from each other?
I think there's a lot of conversation around fried chicken in the last few years in New Zealand and internationally. I think there's a massive hunger for it, and it's not...
Yeah, everyone's jumping on that bandwagon.
The more the merrier. there's actually another one opening on Courtney Place. You know about that one? Yeah. So it's just something that is like pizza, I guess. I think it's forever, unless a massive swing away from naughty food.
Yep.
Took place, but I don't see it going anywhere.
No.
We love what we offer there. We're happy to evolve it if the market shifts, like we've talked about with all of our businesses.
Yeah.
And for now she's clucking along.
Cool. And jumping back to pizza, specialist product, really.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so staff.
Sure.
How's that process for you? Because there's got to be very few people that you can hire that already know how to do what needs to be done.
Yeah, it's almost zero. We've had one in recent memory who came in with specific 18-inch dough stretching skills, and that was a godsend. We had to tweak some of his methods to suit our pizza, but it's almost better to hire the personality than the skill, because to retrain someone who's had different, not necessarily poor, there's many ways to make pizza, but methods that are different to ours will need to untrain then retrain.
Yep.
And that can be often as hard as training a blank slate, particularly if you have pushback around methods. So we prefer to try to find personalities that we think are interested in being a part of a team, being a team player, offering a customer experience which is matches what we're trying to achieve, and just generally ready and keen to get stuck in and learn a new thing, because it is something that can only be learned through repetition. You can be keen, but that won't make you make pizza well on the first day. It's only through repetition and a desire to learn that you'll get there. So we try to hire along those terms.
Cool.
We have developed, this is I guess one of the biggest developments of the business over time, systems which allow the staff to get from zero to hero in the quickest time possible.
Yep.
So we've really broken down and documented each stage of the process and used. I've got a bunch of metaphors that everyone gets sick of hearing, defining the crusts. And and we just really try to have a culture that focuses everything on the newest person on staff and bringing them up rather than showing them how good you are at your job. If the senior pizza makers are doing their job, they're not actually making pizza, they're teaching all shift long. And we have structures that, I mean, this is a hypothetical world. It doesn't always work like this, as you well know, but that's the theory.
That's a really hard skill to teach people as well, though.
It's very weird. It's very tactile.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the teaching or
well,
the,
I mean
the stretching?
Yeah, I mean the stretching as well. Well, I mean, I get that's hard. Like working with any dough is crazy hard. But how do you go about that? I really like that statement you just made before about the best mm-hmm. pizza makers are the ones teaching others, not trying to do them all themselves. Because that's something I struggle with convincing, mm-hmm. you know, newly senior chefs especially.
Sure.
How to step back in order to improve the Everyone quality else. Across the board.
Yeah. We've battled with it. And there's sort of the human tendency to, once you've achieved a skill, to keep honing that and to show everyone how good you are at it. I guess we try to sell it in a way that is a little bit selfish, in that you'll tell them their lives will become easier if these people are better. You'll get the shifts you need to work will change. Our ability to cover shifts if someone is sick will have a lot more options if more people have a similar skill level. And as with most human decision making, if there's some self-interest on the table, that can be a good motivator.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Hiring, I guess, service staff from corporate Featherston Street to 1 o'clock in the morning on Corney Place. Mm-hmm. How do you think about that?
When we hire, we often don't have a site in mind or a roster in mind for the person that we're hiring. And something I ask a series of questions before we even meet in person, and they include, what is your experience in the Corney Place environment late at night? Is it an environment that you feel hypothetically comfortable in? Yep. What are your sleeping patterns? What are your hobbies, and when do they fall? Yep. And you try to. There's no point putting a square peg in a round hole. So that's the saying, right?
Yeah, that's fine.
And for some people who are night owls and don't particularly have an interest in going out on Saturday night, the shifts at Corney Place are great and they work well. For other people who aren't that, we try to put them in a place that will suit their lifestyle. Because if you have a bad match, that will just really come out over time, and it'll come out to the customer. Yeah. If you've got yawning staff, no bueno, or staff who clearly don't feel comfortable in the environment, it's just no good for the customer.
Yeah. Well, what's your favourite pizza?
What's my favourite pizza? I struggle to go away from a classic margarita. Yeah. Pretty much any pizzeria. I know it's kind of a cliche thing for pizza makers to say.
That's awesome.
But when I go to a new joint, the margarita or the equivalent thereof, so the plain slice or the whatever's the simplest pie, That's my go-to, and similar with Tommy's, like I still crave and still smash a fair amount of pizza, and the margarita is generally the go-to. But I do like having specials on and trying new things. With you may have seen Gone to the Dark Side, sort of, with the current special, which is called Original Sin, and it's the first time, this will make Steve go lose his mind, first time that the forbidden fruit pineapple has made its way onto our menu. It's not quite the you can doll chopped up chunks. I guess a refined roasted pureed salsa with jalapeno and red onion, and there's a grown up Hawaiian, but
cool.
I over time have just got more comfortable with removing rules and expectations around what does go on a pizza, and moving away from that sort of the old, if they don't do it in Naples, then it's not authentic or not real or not good, because that's just provably wrong. You can have your own take on pineapple, but there's things that they don't do in Naples which are provably delicious.
Yeah.
And I don't think you should put those type of barriers. I think you should respect and understand tradition, but be happy to challenge some of the rules that have been put up by, I don't know where the committee, I don't know when that committee met, they didn't invite me. So it seems like they've got a lot of rules.
Speaking about rules, making pizza at home,
mm-hmm.
do you have any like key little bits and pieces that kind of would help someone out wanting to make a
pie
at home?
Yeah, sure. This is something that we have given a lot. It's probably one of the most commonly asked questions along these lines. I've actually got a recipe and a method, which I'm happy to email out if anyone wants it, just to email in. But general broad rules, the longer you give your dough to ferment, the better your product will be. So try to get a day ahead at least, make the dough, probably cut the yeast way back from what the recipe says, unless it's a pizza maker's recipe. Your commercial bread recipes tend to massively overstate the amount of yeast you need. Chuck it in the fridge overnight, pull it out, allow it to warm up for a couple of hours before you use it. Get your oven as hot as humanly possible. So whether that's cranking, if yours happens to have a clean cycle, you can put it on that, which gets it super hot. Putting a stone or a steel is sort of
steel seems
on trend now. Yeah. Pizza steel. Get that as hot as you can, and just try to handle the dough as gently as possible. I mean, it can be hard to stretch out by hand at home. You can use some form of rolling device, but just try to treat it as gently as possible and maintain as much of the air structure as you can, and you'll generally be on a good track.
Is that why stretching dough is better than rolling dough? Is it the air?
Yeah, it's that's pretty much the sole reason. It's that you can't develop a crust or a cornicione, the edge piece with an open hole structure and airy bubbles if you flatten the thing entirely. And so that's basically all of our stretching methods are aimed at preserving that outer crust of about 1 centimeter and allowing that to do its thing once it hits the hot stone.
Cool. Hey, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. That's awesome. Thanks for taking the time to listen to us today. Check out honeycomb.co.nz for information and links relating to this episode. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you'll never miss an episode.